Green star Betty Davis receives a Look magazine award from Bob Hope for outstanding film work. And Jimmy Stewart, whose role in Harvey made it one of the outstanding pictures of the year, is similarly honored. Harvey, brilliantly adapted for the screen, is one of Universal International's hits of the current motion picture season. President Truman inspects the yearly exhibits of the White House News Photographers Association. In the sports field, the first prize goes to Henry Burroughs for a vivid boxing scene. Bruce Hortel wins top honors for his study of General Ike, and again wins with his coverage of the assassination attempt on the president, who seems to like himself in the role of a miner. Mr. Truman passes out the awards. The grand prize goes to Wellner Streets of the Times Herald for his gripping and topical photograph entitled Daddy's Girl. Once again, lensmen turn in work that will live in photographic history. With the supreme grace that has won him top laurels all over the world, Dick Button of the United States gives an exhibition of his skating prowess in Vienna. Fresh from his victory in the World Figure Skating Championships in Italy, which he won hands down, Dick continues his triumphant tour. Here he goes into a fast spin. While his youthful admirers look on, the camera presents a slow-motion example of Button's record-breaking skill on ice. In the realm of figure skating, there is no present contender who can top Dick Button's perfection. Senate Crime Investigation Committee shifts its operations to Washington, where Attorney General J. Howard McGrath is among the witnesses. He urgently recommends new legislation to curb interstate gambling information. He is followed to the stand by J. Edgar Hoover, chief of the FBI, who makes an eloquent plea for stronger law enforcement at the local level, where he says the real evil lies.
The gambling problem must be viewed as a phase of the entire crime picture. Organized gambling is a vicious evil. It corrupts our youth and blights the lives of our adults. It becomes a springboard for other crimes, embezzlement, robbery, and even murder. But like any other type of crime, it can be controlled. If the laws against gambling presently on the state and local statute books were earnestly and vigorously enforced, organized gambling could be eliminated within 48 hours in any community in this land. No criminal, the gambler and his allies included, can long stand up before a determined, intelligent, and informed public opinion. That, in my opinion, is the basic answer to the gambling problem, an aroused public opinion which will act on a local level through local law enforcement authorities to wipe out the menace.
Still to come on Year by Year, the Korean War rages on, and the front page news of 1951. Rosenberg gets the death sentence. The 22nd Amendment is passed, limiting the presidency to two terms. And CBS has the first commercial color television broadcast. You are watching Year by Year on the History Channel.
Operation Killer in Korea grinds steadily forward and northward, where United Nations forces face a new adversary, mud. The problem of bringing their superior firepower to bear is a back-breaking job for the Allies, but it is always accomplished. Time out for an open-air trim with the big guns providing the barbershop harmony. For weeks during the battle for strategic Wonju, artillery takes a murderous toll as General MacArthur pays another of his many inspection trips to the fighting front. Here he is greeted by General Matthew Ridgway, his new field commander. Cleaning the Reds off the ridges with concentrated fire is part of the strategy, which has taken a toll of hundreds of thousands in the commie ranks.
Big
stubbornly retreating Reds are detonated as the steady tank advance continues. Even with these precautions, tanks become frequent battle casualties, but still they advance and pour a hail of steel into the enemy. On the long, slow road back to the 30th parallel, enemy dead litter the landscape. Despite natural barriers and the ever-present mud, Allied mechanized convoys continue to press forward and northward. A 250,000 Americans are now committed to the Korean struggle under the United Nations banner, according to General Bradley. Terrain, weather, and a ruthless foe continue to test men and equipment in a conflict that must go far to determine whether freedom will triumph over slavery. On the famed Appian Way outside of Rome, a 2-in-1 racing car with an 8-cylinder engine in one nacelle is piloted by Pietro Taruffi in a bid for the world's record over a mile course. Taruffi, one of Italy's ace speed drivers, designed and built the novel racer that resembles a P-38 without wings. But wings notwithstanding, Taruffi flies to a new speed record for his class, clocking over 200 miles an hour on the mile track. The announcement of his record-shattering run is greeted with enthusiasm in Italian racing circles, and Pietro is greeted upon his return as the man of the hour. 1,500 happy Marines arrive at Oakland, California from the Korean battlefront. Back from the bloody, bitter struggle where they performed so heroically, these fighting leathernecks of the famous 1st Division get a royal welcome from relatives, sweethearts, and friends. Those debarking from the big transport include many who were wounded in the battle against the Reds. But now the pain and the strife are temporarily forgotten as they are reunited with their loved ones. But there is a different side to the picture. At San Francisco, the ship delivers the first war dead disinterred from Korean graves, the first in history ever to be returned to the United States while war still raged in the areas where they were buried. All branches of the service are represented. The solemn ceremonies are witnessed by the bereaved families whose sons and husbands made the supreme sacrifice for freedom. These waves at the Lakehurst, New Jersey Air Station pack their parachutes with extra special care, for they're going to use them. It's graduation day at the Parachute Riggers School. The day everything else is dropped, and a wave's very life depends upon the skill and finesse she acquired at school. Booted, helmeted, and thoroughly equipped for the crucial test, they wait for the big moment when they hit the silk they so carefully packed. Now, out you go, girls! Geronimo welcomes you to the fold. They all graduate with flying colors, without a qualm in a plane load. And despite a stiff breeze that could have warranted postponing the event, the Navy's lady sailors make it to terra firma without a mishap. Every year is leap year for these classy lassies. Hockey bows out for the season in a burst of excitement at Toronto. Here it's Maple Leafs versus Canadiens in the Stanley Cup Finals, with the Toronto Stars leading 3-1. This is the playoff. +14,000 hockey fans see the Montrealers draw first blood. Richard shoots it in, and the Canadiens are out front. They're a better team than they were during the regular season. Prove that when they eliminated the Red Wings in the semifinals. In the third period, with the score 2-1 against them, the Leafs fight hard to tie it up. With the Canadiens fighting just as grimly to hold on to their slim lead, this fifth game of the Cup Series is packed with thrills. With defeat only 28 seconds away, Todd Sloan of the Leafs bangs it in past goalie McNeil, and the place is bedlam. No wonder the fans are in a frenzy. Every game in the series has gone into overtime. The Maple Leafs go into this one with a vim that spells sudden death to the Canadiens. Lorenzo slams it in to win the game and the Stanley Cup, and his teammates promptly elect him Man of the Hour. Joy reigns supreme for the world's champions of hockey. The word from Toronto, where leading hairstylists from all over congregated this week, is shorter hair for you gals. And here are some of the coiffures cooked up by the experts who say so. This one's called Fantasy, by way of Paris. Also Parisian is this arrangement, especially created for cocktail parties, old-fashioned at that. The Greek-Roman influence is apparent in this design, while a spray of spring flowers is a crowning touch for this hairdo. This coiffure won first prize for its designer. Other awards were based on originality alone. For instance, we don't know what the Toronto subway has to do with shorter hair. Oh, it's over any man's head. Ordinary plane takeoff and landing gear is replaced by Caterpillar traction equipment. The device is demonstrated attached to a light plane, but can be adapted to any size aircraft. More efficient takeoffs, faster airspeeds, and landings are claimed for this Caterpillar-equipped light plane by its pioneer, Count Bonmartini of Italy. He experimented with tractor landing gears as early as 1928, but his World War II experience, where he saw airfields turned into lakes of mud, gave him the idea for a plane that carries its own runway.
When Year by Year returns, the battle between Harry Truman and Douglas MacArthur. Stay with us. General Douglas MacArthur, hero of the South Pacific, architect of the brilliant invasion of Incheon, came home from Korea. The general had been relieved of his command by the commander-in-chief, President Harry Truman. MacArthur violated a presidential gag order when he publicly disagreed with Truman by advocating airstrikes on the Chinese mainland. Now join us for one of the biggest news stories.
After 14 long years, General MacArthur comes home. Preceded by Mrs. MacArthur and followed by 13-year-old son Arthur, the hero of the Pacific debarks at San Francisco to deafening cheers. Governor Warren of California has a warm welcome for the man whose dismissal has stirred the nation. Mrs. MacArthur and her son, who charmed the crowd, share the limelight in a throng which all but overwhelms the general in its enthusiasm. This was but a prelude to a parade the following day, during which 500,000 San Franciscans cheered themselves hoarse all along the line of march. All political aspirations were firmly rejected by the Pacific commander. A little Korean miss sees General MacArthur drive off to receive an ovation from the city whose earthquake and fire he helped fight 45 years before. A joint meeting of the two houses of Congress is assembled to hear General MacArthur state his case on the Far East policy. He receives a tumultuous welcome as he is greeted by Vice President Barkley and Speaker of the House, Rayburn. Members applaud not the issues nor the great debate. They applaud a great soldier and patriot who opens his address with characteristic candor.
I address you with neither rancor nor bitterness. In the fading twilight of life, with one purpose in mind, to serve my country.
An old soldier delivers his touching valedictory.
I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day. which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
MacArthur Day in New York. The big town makes it a five-star welcome for the five-star hero of the Pacific. The world's greatest city says, welcome home with the greatest demonstration in its history. Mrs. MacArthur and young Arthur share with him the cheers of the multitude. The veritable blizzard of paper is a full measure of New York's enthusiasm. West Side, all around the big town, they form solid walls of humanity for 37 miles along the homecoming route. And the weather, perfect. Just about everybody is out today. An estimated 7.5 million men, women, and children. City Hall Square is jammed. Spring rains turn the Korean fighting front into a vast quagmire, through which United Nations troops slog doggedly and slowly forward to take up new positions against the expected communist drive. Patrols probe advanced elements of enemy forces, constantly harassing a slowly retreating foe. Overhead, Allied planes bomb without let-up. The bombardment is directed at an estimated 800,000 Reds massed for an expected spring offensive. President Truman signs the Selective Service Bill, which lowers the draft age from 19 to 18 and a half years for the nation's young men. It also lays the groundwork for universal military training in the future. He presents the pen to Secretary of Defense Marshall, who praises the new law and explains the effect it will have in the present critical world situation.
Signing by the President a few minutes ago, the Universal Military Training and Service Law represents a step of great historic significance. It'll enable us to face the uncertainties of an explosive international situation with the knowledge that we can be strong militarily without having to imperil our security economically, no matter how long the present world tension may continue. And it will permit us thereafter to continue strong militarily in keeping with our great purpose of promoting the peace of the world.
In a series of dawn raids, FBI agents swooped down on communists indicted on charges of advocating the violent overthrow of the government. Prominent among the 17 arrested is Israel Amter. 21 indictments were handed down under the Smith Act, recently upheld by the United States Supreme Court. As these pictures were made, four were being sought. Frederick Vanderbilt Field vainly tried to bail four defendants, and Eugene Dennis, now under prison sentence, is also present. Following arraignment, women defendants, including Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Claudia Jones, awaiting deportation proceedings, Marianne Backrock, and Betty Gannett, are removed to the House of Detention, held under heavy bail. They follow the 11 communists already convicted after a lengthy trial. Department of Justice officials have promised further arrests as the crackdown on suspected subversives gathers momentum.
Still to come on Year by Year, the running of the bulls. Francis the Talking Mule, and what was new in 1951, garage door openers and Orida potatoes. You are watching Year by Year on the History Channel.
Highly spiced with all the ingredients needed for a well-rounded diet of speed and thrills and spine-tingling excitement, 1951 was a big year in sports. Season in and season out, the kings and queens of sports dramatic domain cooked up new recipes and set out to prove that records are made only to be broken, that perfection is never a static quality. And what a year it was for baseball and the New York Giants. Leo DeRocha's miracle team spotted the Dodgers a 13-game lead in mid-August, then overtook them, forcing a three-game playoff. Remember Branca's fatal pitch and Bobby Thompson's storybook home run in the ninth inning of the third game that gave the Giants the pennant? The Polo Grounds burst its seams that afternoon when Thompson's blast exploded the Dodgers into oblivion and gave the Giants their first pennant in many a long year. With all due respect to the Yankees, the World Series was an anticlimax after this dramatic windup of the National League race. America loves baseball and it loves miracles. It got both in 1951. The basketball scene was dominated by titans of the court like Brigham Young and Kentucky, winner of the National Collegiates. But bigger than basketball itself were the scandals that came to light. The bribes by the fixers and the games dumped that brought dishonor and jail sentences to young athletes. West Point rocked with scandal, too. The nation shocked by word that 90 cadets had been dismissed for violating the Point's ancient honor code. Practically the entire football squad was wiped out, and a new team had to be built from scratch. Biggest number on the grid scene was 42, Princeton's dashing Dick Kazmaier, the triple threat tailback from Maumee, Ohio. Top man in almost every football poll in the country, Kaz ran and passed and booted his way into football's Hall of Fame. Tennessee was rated the top team of the land, but Kazmaier ran away with the individual honors. The daring do of touchdown Dick in 51 will long be remembered by football fans. Churchill Downs in the Kentucky Derby, richest in history, and a slow-motion record of a stunning upset by a hitherto unknown 15-1 shot. Count Turf, son and grandson of Derby winners, hitting the biggest jackpot in the history of America's great Turf Classic. His owner once sold peanuts at the ballpark, but he rode the gravy train at Churchill Downs. Count Turf, making Derby Day 1951 unforgettable. The big story in golf was the little man who came back. Texas Ben Hogan, once so badly injured in an auto accident, nobody thought he'd ever play again. But he did, and at Birmingham he holed out with a 3-under par to win the Open, his third U.S. Open title. The biggest little guy in golf. Boxing had its two-fisted impact on the sporting scene. And out of the slam bang came the defeat of Ezard Charles at Pittsburgh by the veteran Jersey Joe Walcott. Prayer and stubborn determination brought a new world's heavyweight champ. Track and field had its records and its heroes, and topping them all was the sky-climbing Parson from California. The Reverend Bob Richards vaulted into the headlines by becoming the second man in history to top 15 feet. The vaulting vicar's elation over his feat was very justifiable and very understandable. Ever in search of new thrills, Mr. and Mrs. Sporting Public cut fancy capers for the camera. And whatever the element, earth, sky, or water, there was always the element of chance. When man risks his neck in quest of new laurels, he takes his spills with his thrills. And for the spectator, there's always the suspense of wondering, will he make it or won't he? The ski jumping scene provided many a swift answer. Yes, there were many who fell by the snowy wayside. Bobsledding, where disaster lurked at every icy turn. The West was still the Wild West at rodeo time, and many a buckaroo bit the dust trying to stay aboard a beefy Brahma or a bucking Bronco. The year saw many a rip-snorting ride and many a bone-bruising fall as man and beast lopped horns. This mob scene, starring the bull, plural, plus a large supporting cast of Homo sapiens, is a big annual shindig in Spain. They call it Folding the Bull, and its success is gauged by the number of bones broken and bulls baited into bellicosity. Hey, who pushed? It was a toss-up who won, El Toro or El Toreador. Bills and thrills came thick and fast at Aintree, England, where the Grand National Steeplechase saw 37 starters, but only three surviving the grueling 4.5-mile classic. We'll slow down the action to show one of the most spine-chilling pileups in Grand National history. 11 jockeys and their mounts came to grief at this one jump, and the race had hardly begun. Never in over 100 years had Aintree seen disaster strike on such a scale. The motorcycle maniacs continued on their dizzy rounds with results as anticipated and sometimes quite unexpected. Perhaps the thrillingest, chillingest sports spectacle of all 1951 occurred during a hot rod race at Langhorne, Pennsylvania. In a nightmare of crashing confusion, scores of cars cracked up. It happened so fast there wasn't time to flag the oncoming vehicles down, and the drivers, their vision obscured by the smoke of flaming wrecks, kept coming on, seemingly powerless to avoid the fate that lay just around the bend. Miraculously, not a driver lost his life in this unbelievable tangle of traffic gone berserk. But in only a little more than 60 seconds, a year of drama and excitement in sports was brought into sharp focus. No doubt about it, 1951 rang down the curtain on sports with a hair-raising spectacle that will be remembered as long as men risk their lives for fame and fortune. Francis the Mule received an honorary degree from Goodwill Industries in Los Angeles in recognition, quote, of his achievements, including his reputed ability to talk, unquote. Yep, that's what she says. Complete with cap and gown, the four-footed movie star gets the hood, making him Doctor of Mulosophy. Just call me Doc. Inside the diploma, there's stashed a carrot, and with that, Francis goes to the races. The muscle men mingle in Los Angeles, and setting a new world's record in the national weightlifting contest is John Davis of Brooklyn. 340 pounds, and Davis shakes his head. And don't ask me why. Doug Hepburn tries the same weight. Lightweight Joe DiPietro of Paterson, New Jersey, lifts 230 pounds to take first in his class. Now the bicep boys make with the muscles, seeking this year's Mr. America title. Now, please, girls, no whistling. Roy Elligan of Oakland, California seems to be head and shoulders above the crowd. Yep, Roy Elligan gets the nod, the title and the trophy. Mr. America of 1951.
This is America, more than 3 million square miles between two oceans. In it live 150 million Americans. Millions of us work hard and earn money to buy the goods we ourselves produce. In June of last year, an army crossed the 38th parallel in Korea. Once more, we were threatened with war. People remembered wartime shortages and rushed to buy all sorts of goods. Prices began to rise. You had to pay more for food and clothing. And as a taxpayer, you had to pay more for the weapons and supplies needed for defense. We were heading into a dangerous inflation. In January 1951, price ceilings were established for most of the things Americans buy. This helped to check inflation. But price control alone cannot do the job. The real job is up to you. You and your 150 million fellow Americans.
The full impact of producing for defense will come in late summer or early fall. Consumer purchasing power will be increased. At the same time, defense production will be taking a larger share of our gross national product. The inflationary pressures will be stronger than ever. Our price stabilization program can succeed if we have the active support of you, the consumer, and of all Americans. Buy only what you need. Pay no more than ceiling prices. Working together, we can and will defeat inflation.
Still to come on Year by Year, Hollywood Wives and the fashions of the day, plus our index of what things cost in 1951. To the three-bedroom house with a mortgage rate of 4.25% was $9,000.
Screen star Joyce Holden opens a novel fashion show presentation before the ladies of the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers in Hollywood. This century of fashion also reveals Anne Blythe in a dashing black, gold, and silver brocade evening gown, styled in the mode of 100 years ago. These are all Universal International stars, and their costumes were designed especially for wear in current feature pictures. For instance, here is Susan Ball, who models, as did Anne Blythe, a costume worn in the motion picture World in His Arms from the Rex Beach story. Coming up through the years, Wanda Hendricks appears, complete with bustle. Just the thing a kid from Texas would wear in 1875. And Lynn Barry brings the fashion century up to 1925 with this fetching flapper model. The perfect picture of the lost generation that inspired John Hell Jr. and F. Scott Fitzgerald. Piper Laurie gives us her version of the same era, with all the trimmings. Oh, what will money, money buy next century? ...6,000 fans jam Memorial Coliseum in Los Angeles for a battle of Coast Titans, Southern Cal and Stanford. Carmichael goes for 24 as the Trojans, trailing 7-0, finally get underway in the third period. Gibber goes the distance to knock the score, to the delight of USC fans. On the first play of the fourth quarter, Carmichael breaks loose again for the Trojans, cracks the Stanford engines on a one-man warpath for 36 yards all told, and a tally that puts Southern Cal out front. But the big story of a big game is written on the ensuing kickoff. Bob Mathias returns it, and he's a story in himself. The Olympic decathlon champ hasn't played much football for Stanford, but he's stealing the show today with a 96-yard touchdown romp that electrifies the crowd and spurs his team to victory. Still trailing in the closing minutes of play, Stanford begins to roll. Kerkorian's long toss is taken by Morley. And a few plays later, Mathias scores his second touchdown, and it's a 20-20 ball game. Desperate measures by desperate Trojans provide the turning point. Gifford's pass is intercepted by Christ of Stanford, who races 29 yards to the Southern Cal 12. Victory for Stanford and the inside track to the Rose Bowl as Hugasian scores the winning touchdown. In Santa Rosa, California, workmen swarm over a building site at a given signal, off and away to build the fastest house on record. Last year, a local contractor did it in 6 hours. Today, he and his eager beaver builders are out to slice that mark in half. A prefabricated chimney swings into place in the $10,000 home, which will be raffled off at $1 a ticket. The proceeds to be used to build a recreation center for local youngsters. Everything fits, and every man knows where it goes and where he goes. Tight squeezes don't mean a thing when you're racing the clock, and this army of workmen have sallied forth to battle time to a standstill. After the shingles come the painters, off in a rush with a brush. As the final touches are applied, the movers get a move on, and 3 hours and 5 minutes after the starting gun went off, the house is finished. There's even a garden planted and lawn all seeded. Home sweet home in a hurry. Thousand fight fans are out in Berlin to see Gerhard Hecht, the German light heavyweight champion, clash in a non-title bout with the visiting world middleweight champ Sugar Ray Robinson of New York. At ringside is Mrs. Robinson and Sugar Ray's sister, and they see a lot more than just another fight. Winner of 126 pro bouts with only one defeat, Robinson quickly displays his mastery over the German. The referee starts the count, but stops when Hecht's handlers charge their boy had been floored by a kidney punch. The ref also grants the fallen idol of Berlin a 1-minute respite for medical examination. Apparently still smarting over the pasting Joe Louis gave Max Schmeling years ago, the fans are boiling at this point. And heck, keeps them boiling with dramatic effect. Meanwhile, Robinson waits patiently in his corner for the verdict that his opponent is physically okay. And the fight goes on. For 10 seconds it goes on. Again, Heck turns as Robbie bores in, and down he goes, clutching at his back. Again, his handlers scream foul. The fans take up the chant of protest, and the referee disqualifies Robinson, a blot on a fine record. On top of that, he has to duck a barrage of bottles and other missiles thrown into the ring. 6 hours later, the West Berlin Boxing Commission set aside the disqualification verdict, ruling it a no-decision fight. But right now, a thoroughly pulverized Gerhard Hecht is dragged to his corner, and an angry mob, incited, some say, by communist troublemakers, heaps both abuse and bottles on Sugar Ray Robinson. Led to safety by 20 Berlin policemen, Robbie escapes without injury, his outstanding fight record unblemished. This rubble-strewn area is typical of what might happen to any of America's big cities if an atom bomb should fall. In an all-out mobilization of its civil defense forces, New York City goes on the alert following a simulated atomic attack. A strenuous 2.5-hour test. Firefighters and other emergency groups demonstrate their ability to cope with situations which might arise after a bombing and test the effectiveness of their training. Civil Defense Director Wallander and city officials praised the efficiency of the volunteers. The evacuation of the injured would be of major importance should an A-bomb actually fall on any of our country's busy ports or industrial centers. It's up to all of us to realize the danger and respond to the appeal for civil defense volunteers. With a bang-up parade, New York City opens the observance of Women in the Armed Forces Week. All four branches of the women's services are represented as the gallant gals march proudly along Broadway to City Hall. The WACs, WAFs, WAVES, and Marines are welcomed by Mayor and Pelletieri, Helen Hayes, and Mrs. Anna Rosenberg, Assistant Secretary of Defense. In response to a nationwide appeal for an additional 72,000 young women, the largest group ever enlisted from this area is sworn in. Mrs. Rosenberg stressed the responsibility of women to serve in the present crisis.
1951 was a year of rising fears and falling heroes. People worried about inflation, and the flames of anti-communist hysteria were fanned by the conviction of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg for treason. On April 11th, President Truman relieved General Douglas MacArthur of his command. The administration was furious when MacArthur went public with his proposal to attack communist positions inside China. Bidding the nation a last farewell, the general said, "Old soldiers never die, they just fade away."
A shrieking monolith, deliberately buried by an alien intelligence, starts man on a mission 500 million miles into space. With three of its five crew asleep in hibernation, spacecraft Discovery 1 voyages towards Jupiter. Controlling the mission is a talking computer known as HAL.
HAL, you're the brain and central nervous system of the ship. Does this ever cause you any lack of confidence?
Let me put it this way, Mr. Aimer. No 9,000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information.
In the first year of the 21st century, there is strange and wondrous beauty, startling experiences that jolt and mystify, and the danger of complete obliteration.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
And now, your journey is just beginning.
Mm-hmm. rebuilt and re-edited all the stuff, and it sounds pretty good. Let's see how it does if anybody really likes this. Now, if you like it, download some more, plus my zip files, Johnny81 and his zip files. See if you like them. Please send all donations to the Murphy Retirement Fund at 2010 Powell Avenue, Apartment 6 Charlie, Bronx, New York City, 10472. Phone number is 718-597-2967. Thank you kindly.